It's time to hear from the Green Party with co-leader James Shaw.
Today I spoke to Green Party co-leader James Shaw about a bill that aims to eliminate discrimination on those with disability assistance animals. We then spoke about the Ministry of Justice multi-victimisation report, and lastly we spoke about last week's school strike for climate march, which happened on Friday across several locations around the country.
Let's talk about this bill that aims to eliminate discrimination based on disability assistance animals. Could you outline what this bill aims to achieve?
Yeah, so this is a members bill, and it was actually first developed by a former colleague of mine, Mojo Mathers, who was the country's first deaf MP. The idea is that it amends the Human Rights Act, which currently says guide dogs, and it changes it from guide dogs to disability assist dogs. And the idea there is basically that we want to protect everybody who uses a disability assist dog.
So, yeah, this is a legacy bill that's sort of been floating around for some time and has finally been brought back into Parliament. Could you explain how that process works for me?
Yeah, so members' bills are put up by MPs right across the House. Doesn't matter if they're in the government side or the opposition side. As long as they're not ministers. So I can't put up a members bill because I'm a minister. And they generally focus on quite narrow things like this bill does, where there is actually a genuine problem that needs fixing, but it's not high enough up the government's priority list, I guess, for them to kind of, turn the full power of government on it. And so, you've had a number of bills recently, like Todd Muller, who's, the former National Party leader. He had a bill to do with consumer protections around sunscreen, which is, again, it's a very narrow thing, but it is actually something where there's a genuine problem that needs fixing. And that's exactly the case with this bill here, where because the Human Rights Act was written at a time, I guess, where we were kind of less aware or conscious of the needs of people with a range of disabilities, the Act got written up to say guide dogs, right, to deal with dogs that assist people who have the disability of blindness, but that excludes, people who are deaf, people who, might have a medical condition that means that they have seizures a lot, PTSD, Alzheimer's, and disability assist dogs are used for all of those things.
So as you said, this bill was written by Mojo Mathers, but this isn't the first of her bills that has been brought up since she left Parliament, is it?
No, she's one of the luckiest former MPs around. So a couple of years ago, Chloe Swarbrick had inherited a bill from Mojo, which is around... it's called the Disability Access Bill, and it amended the Electoral Act, and it's really about ensuring that there's resources and a specific program for outreach to people when it comes to election time, to make sure that people with disabilities have full access to the democratic process, whether that's as a voter or actually as a candidate, because obviously, running for Parliament is, takes considerable time and resources, and people who are living with particular disabilities often are excluded from that process because they can't afford it or there are kind of access issues, which means that they can't fully participate as a candidate. And so that bill went through the House and is currently making its way into the kind of planning and so on for upcoming elections, which is great.
How do these non-discrimination bills get enforced?
It varies wildly depending on what it is that, what you're talking about. And so usually it comes down to having a kind of a complaints system. So if someone feels that they are being discriminated against, then there's a process by which they can, contact some agency and to say, look, there's a problem here, and then there'll be some kind of intervention. But it does differ, quite a lot across the range of non-discrimination laws that there are.
All right, so now let's talk about the Ministry of Justice Māori Victimisation Report. What were the key findings of that report?
Well, look, this was a bit depressing because it's roughly the same as where it was 15 years ago, which was a similar report on Māori victimisation. So what this report that came out last week showed is that Māori, there's a victimisation rate of 38% compared to 30% for the general population, so it's almost a quarter as many more Māori are victims of crime as the general population. And that hasn't moved considerably in 15 years, which is not great, obviously.
Yeah, so as you say, this is something that's been known and discussed time and time again. I guess the question is, how many reports do we need before we can acknowledge the scale of this issue?
Yeah, look, I mean, I don't have a good answer to that question, and it is a very good question. I get a bit sick of seeing reports year after year that say roughly the same thing, and government not really responding to it with the kind of resourcing and effort that you know is going to make a difference. I hope this time that there's a government in place that will look at that and say, this isn't good enough. I mean, one thing that has changed in the last 15 years. Is that there's considerably greater Māori representation both in Parliament but also in the Cabinet, in government. And I know that the current government's Māori caucus have taken this quite seriously, but obviously this report only came out last week, so we'll have to wait and see what gets picked up.
So what sort of response does the Green Party want from the government in order to address this issue?
Well, I mean, really it comes down to significant investment in Māori health, education, employment, housing, welfare. You know, I mean, most of this is attributable to poverty and systemic racism. And so the kind of solutions here have to be equally systemic. It's not about just kind of locking more people up or anything like that, because we know that clearly doesn't work and has actually failed as a strategy over the last few decades.
Yeah, so we also see these figures of compounding factors such as disability and sexuality, which once again we've known about for several years, and we keep being told that these issues exist, but what reassurance can you give that they'll actually be addressed?
Well, ultimately that is a question for the Minister of Justice, Chris Farfoy, and for the Prime Minister. I mean, I think it's just one of those things where, you've got to say, look, time's up here. We've got to crack on with it.
So in this press release that you guys released about this topic, as well as the last time that we spoke, you talk about this philosophy of having a response that matches the scale of the issue. What is the appropriate response here, and why is there so much resistance to implementing sweeping changes that can actually tackle this issue?
Well, I think, I think that broadly speaking, it's not that there's resistance to tackling the issue, it's that the kind of scale and the kind of complexity of the response, like you say, has to meet the scale and complexity of the challenge. So you're talking about, like I said, right, you talk about health, education, employment, housing, welfare, all of those things. And the government is doing things in all of those areas, but I have to say, I think it's constrained by this kind of general philosophy that we've inherited over the last 30 years, which is that, we want kind of first-class public services and so on, but we're not prepared to pay the taxes required to actually deliver those things. And so the obsession over the last 30 years with having a government that is, debt-free at all times and balances the books, and at the same time actually has tax rates, below most of the OECD, you think you cannot have your cake and eat it too. You know, we either want to solve these problems or we don't.
So lastly, let's talk about the most recent school strike for climate, which took place on Friday. I first want to ask about your feelings in seeing young people taking significant action like this. How does that sort of thing make you feel?
Well, look, I was really pleased. I was at the Wellington rally because I'm based in Wellington, but I know that there were events going on, significant events going on in Auckland and Palmerston North and Christchurch, Dunedin and so on. So all right up and down the country. And I think I was worried that COVID-19, you know, would have completely derailed the movement. Because we sort of built up a real head of steam in 2019. You know, we had that massive series of rallies around the country in September of 2019, which brought something like 170,000 people out onto the streets in Aotearoa, which is the largest set of marches that we've had in this country, probably in 2 decades. And so that I think was a real milestone, and I was just kind of worried that, you know, with COVID-19 and the lockdowns, that all of the momentum and the attention had come off climate change and was starting to kind of people just focusing on getting through the pandemic, which, you know, is understandable, but climate change is still there. And so because it was a really good turnout on Friday and really well organised, I sort of started to get a sense of hope that actually we were going to see the same kind of public pressure in favour of strong climate action this year, which is a critical year here in Aotearoa, but also around the world.
The Green Party has expressed support of the group's demands. Could you outline what some of those are for me?
Well, there's a range, one of which is to do more to support Pacific countries that are right at the front line of climate change, that are experiencing sea level rise, actually greater sea level rise than much of the rest of the country because of the conditions in the Western Pacific, where you're getting much more frequent, much more severe cyclones during cyclone season, in fact sometimes actually outside cyclone season, on the shoulders of the season and so on, which is causing huge amounts of damage and economic chaos in those countries as well. So that was a big part of it. There was, you know, another was to ensure that young people are represented in the decision-making process. And I have to say that is something that I think the government could do a better job of in terms of bringing that intergenerational aspect into decisions, because it does tend to skew in favour of industry, but also legacy industries rather than the kind of you know, new green jobs of the future. And there was a third one, which was around the need for what we call a just transition, which is actually part of the law here now. So the Zero Carbon Act that we passed in 2019 requires both the Climate Change Commission and the government to put in place packages of policies that support industries and workers and regions to transition away from, in particular, fossil fuels and other high pollution industries, but into new industries that, you know, can ensure that people have a good living and a good standard of living in the future as well.
Is there a part of you that feels conflicted about the nation's youth feeling the need to take action by themselves? Does it sort of elicit any concerns about the lack of action from older generations?
Well, I mean, I have to say I have felt that for a very long time. I mean, and you know, I'm in my 40s now, and, you know, for three quarters of my life, we've known about climate change as a country and as a planet, and we have done not just virtually nothing about it, we've actually increased the speed at which we're putting pollution into the atmosphere. So I completely relate to the sense of frustration that today's young people feel, because we have been woeful in our response to climate change.
What reassurances can you give to the youth of Aotearoa that significant climate change policy can be enacted within the next few years?
Well, I mean, I guess one of the things that I said when I spoke at the rally on Friday is that actually they're already making a difference. So the Zero Carbon Act, which is, I have to say, one of the most comprehensive and ambitious legislative and institutional climate change frameworks in law in the world anywhere, was the brainchild of Generation Zero, which is a youth climate movement. And the school strikes that occurred during the passage of the Zero Carbon Act through Parliament were massive and hugely influential on, you know, politicians and on industry. And it was really clear that actually that voice was making itself known and that people were responding to it. So there's already a recent track record of significant legislative reform as a result of that pressure. Now, you know, it's, you know, things are not moving fast enough, and like I said a number of times on Friday, I don't think that we're moving at the scale and speed that we need to yet, but the pace of change is really starting to pick up now. This year is a critical year because this year is the year that we have to put in place a emissions reduction plan for the next 15 years. And so government will be making a number of critical decisions this year. So we really need that support and that social alliance for strong climate action this year.
That was James Shaw for the Green Party. The Wire.